Once you realize that the evidence that dietary fat is, or saturated fat, is causing disease is shoddy at best, it opens up a whole new world of ways to think about obesity. Because one of the things that happened is, until the 1960s, the belief was that carbohydrates were fattening. Bread, pasta, potatoes, sweets just made you fat. If you didn't want to be fat, you didn't eat them. And then we decided that dietary fat and saturated fat cause heart disease, and carbs became heart-healthy diet foods, and suddenly there were the foods we were supposed to eat. And then there were diets like Atkins, which just said, don't eat carbs, you could eat as much fat as you want. And those worked tremendously for weight loss, but people just assumed they'd kill you because of the saturated fat.
This is episode number 93 with Gary Taubes. This episode is brought to you by a company that's made my life significantly easier, and that's Thrive Market. Thrive Market is an online marketplace, and they're on a mission to make healthy living easy and affordable for everyone. It allows you to shop for thousands of the best-selling non-GMO foods and natural products, always at 25 to 50% below retail prices. But as a Pursuing Health listener, you'll receive an additional 25% off your first purchase, plus a free 30-day trial if you visit www.thrivemarket.com/ph. My husband Danny and I have been ordering from Thrive Market for years, and it's helped us to maximize our efficiency with grocery shopping and meal prep in the midst of our busy schedules through medical training. Using Thrive Market, we can shop for all of our staple grocery items, things like nut butters, cooking oils, snacks, dressings, coffee and tea, even personal care products, eco-friendly cleaning supplies, and non-toxic beauty products. We know that they're coming from a curated list of products we can trust. Whether you're looking for paleo, vegan, ketogenic, gluten-free, non-GMO, sustainably farmed, fair trade certified, or any of 80 plus other types of products, you can easily find them by filtering on Thrive Market's platform. And they're all at prices 25 to 50% below retail. Even better, these items are shipped straight to your doorstep, so you never have to worry about the time or hassle of grocery shopping. Here's a few other reasons to love Thrive Market. First, they're the very first company in the country to go 100% zero waste. All of their packaging, boxes, and inserts are made from recycled paper and are recyclable themselves. They're the largest retailer in the country that sells exclusively non-GMO groceries, and more than 70% of the Thrive Market catalog cannot be found on Amazon. It provides greater access to high-quality products at prices comparable to conventional products in supermarkets. This helps to decrease the barriers to healthy living for everyone. We also have the opportunity to vote with our forks every single day to change our food environment in this country, and Thrive Market can help us do so by supporting companies that are also working towards this mission and producing high-quality, healthy, and sustainable foods. So that's why I love Thrive. Thrive's mission again is to make healthy living easy and approachable to everyone, and this aligns perfectly with my own personal mission and that of Pursuing Health. Because it's been such a lifesaver for me, I wanted to share the benefits of Thrive Market with all of you, and they've responded with an amazing offer. So once again, head to thrivemarket.com/ph to receive 25% off your first purchase plus a free 30-day trial. Again, this is on top of their already 25 to 50% below retail prices. Why not try it out and do your grocery shopping from home this week? I hope you can take advantage of this offer and enjoy their service as much as I have. Once again, head to thrivemarket.com/ph to learn more. No discount code necessary, just shop around and the discount will be applied at checkout. This episode is brought to you by ButcherBox. ButcherBox delivers 100% grass-fed and finished beef, free-range organic chicken, and heritage breed pork directly to your doorstep. Now, I think meat can have a place in a well-rounded diet, but there's a huge, huge difference when it comes to animals raised in feedlots that are fed primarily corn and soy and routinely given growth hormones and antibiotics, and those that are responsibly raised, fed their natural diet, and never given growth hormones or antibiotics. ButcherBox gives me some peace of mind, knowing that I can trust my meat is the highest quality out there and that it will taste amazing. They allow you to order curated or custom boxes of meat, and they always come with recipe ideas for you to explore. My husband Danny and I are super excited about firing up our backyard grill this summer to enjoy our ButcherBox selections with tons of vegetables from our local CSA. And you can join us. ButcherBox is extending an awesome offer to you for listening to Pursuing Health. Just head to butcherbox.com/Julie for $20 off your order, plus a free order of their delicious bacon. Again, that's butcherbox.com/Julie. Hope you can check it out and that it makes your life a little bit easier, just as it has done for us. Welcome to Pursuing Health. I'm Julie Fouché, family medicine resident and former CrossFit Games athlete. Here, I bring to you information and inspiration from experts and everyday individuals for how to use lifestyle to maximize health. Thank you so much for joining me. Now let's get started with this week's episode. Well, hello there, and welcome back to Pursuing Health. In this episode, I had the absolute pleasure of sitting down with investigative science and health journalist Gary Taubes just after the 2018 CrossFit Health Conference in Madison, Wisconsin. With a background in physics and a special interest in investigating so-called bad science, Gary turned his attention toward nutrition in the early 2000s. He has since spent the past 15-plus years authoring several books on the topic, including The Case Against Sugar, Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It, and Good Calories, Bad Calories. He's also a contributor to publications such as The New York Times and The Wall Street Journal, and he's won numerous awards for his journalism. Gary is also the co-founder of the nonprofit Nutrition Science Initiative. Gary is well known for sorting through the myths surrounding nutrition and how faulty research and public health recommendations have led to poor food choices and the obesity epidemic over the past several decades. In this episode, we talked about everything from investigating bad science, how our understanding of nutrition and obesity has evolved over the past 15-plus years, and the importance of self-experimentation when it comes to finding the optimal diet for your body. A few quick reminders before we get started. First, this episode is produced by CrossFit Beyond the Whiteboard, the best workout tracking in the biz and the one I've been using since 2009. Learn more at beyondthewhiteboard.com. If you're enjoying this podcast, please head over to iTunes to subscribe and consider giving it a rating. I'm always looking for inspiring stories to share. So if you or someone you know has used lifestyle to overcome a serious health challenge, please send your story to me at info@juliefouché.com and I'll select some to share here on future episodes. Finally, please remember that although I am now officially a doctor, this podcast is meant to share the experiences of individuals and does not provide medical advice. With that, let's get started with episode number 93 of Pursuing Health featuring Gary Taubes. Thank you so much for joining me on Pursuing Health. I'm really excited to be here with Gary Taubes. So.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we're here. It's just been the second day of the CrossFit Health Conference. What is it like for you to be here in the CrossFit community and interacting with some of the attendees here in the world of CrossFit?
First, I feel physically inadequate. Other than that, it's fascinating. CrossFit has been supporters of mine from, before I was aware that mm-hmm. they were supporters of mine. Mm-hmm. And now that with CrossFit Health and the physicians involved, it's kind of a wonderful opportunity to interact with these people, but also mm-hmm. to get feedback to them and just, finding out that I've had an influence is something that never gets tiring.
Yeah.
So getting their insights has been valuable. So it's been a fascinating couple of days. I wish I could stay longer.
That's good to hear. And it's interesting, the first time I think I had ever heard of your work was back in 2011 when you spoke for the CrossFit trainers at their trainer summit, and then they posted it in the CrossFit Journal. And that's when I was in my first year of medical school. And heard your talk and then, got your book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, and then obviously along the way have followed your work. And
so how do you navigate medical school with this sort of, unorthodox, heretical message that I'm giving? I mean, for the most part, I would think that would be a little bit difficult.
It's very difficult.
Yeah.
And I still don't know if I have a good answer or a good approach to it. But it's hard because a lot of times you feel like you don't really know what you can believe that you're learning. And especially, you know, we can get into some of what you talked about yesterday, but looking at the science and the research and the things that our guidelines are based off of, are the things that we're learning in general in medicine, a lot of times doesn't have great evidence, or it's not, we can't go back to the primary evidence for every single recommendation we make. And so a lot of what we learn in medicine is just, well, this is the way we do it. And it's very frustrating to go through your process of learning in that kind of environment where you feel like there's no stable foundation for what you're learning or what you're doing. So at times it can get very difficult.
I can imagine. I mean, I think the key is probably to just remember that just because you've been told to do it this way, that doesn't mean that God told the people who put together the protocol to do it that way. The talk we just heard from Tom Seyfried suggests, as does my work, that people can get trapped into thinking about disease states and sort of the wrong paradigm. And once you do that, everything you do sort of supports some aspect of what you believe, but not the critical aspects. And you forget that this is just one way of looking at the disease, and that there might be other ways of approaching it that are much more, answer more questions, and have much more effective means of prevention and treatment.
Right. And I think in general, just kind of growing up in the system and even being exposed to CrossFit as early as I did, it allowed me to go into things with more of an open mind and to ask those questions and ask why. And even hearing, I think one of the things that gave me the biggest hope was, it was during my second or third year of medical school learning about functional medicine. And this is, again, a big paradigm shift for how do we think about disease and medicine. And that gives me a lot of, it just gives you a lot of hope to see things like Dr. Seyfried is doing, and see that there are a lot of people looking at problems in different ways, and you don't have to just look at it the one way that's the conventional way.
Yeah. Although you always have to think critically and skeptically.
Right.
You know, I have this unique background because I did books on scientists who got the wrong answers and Nobel laureates who got the wrong answers. Then I did books on, so I saw, most of the people who challenge the establishment and do things in unorthodox ways are wrong. Mm-hmm. And in medicine, you've got some good things, some advantages and disadvantages. So advantages, if you've got a person with symptoms and you can cure the symptoms of the disease or the disorder, then you don't really care what the conventional advice is.
Right, if they feel better,
Yeah, if they, you can measure the improvements. All too often, that isn't the case. We're now, we live in a world where we take pharmaceuticals to prevent diseases, and we don't even know really ultimately if they help or hinder. We have a hypothesis and a statistical probability that if we take drug X, we will be less likely to get a heart attack or a stroke. And so you do have this advantage, but then you also have desperate people. And when you have desperate people, you have people who are willing to do anything, and people who are willing to do anything can be taken advantage of. And so you have people who will take advantage of them. And then how do you know whether you're with them?
Right.
And how do you know whether, I mean, it's funny because I have people that, sort of designated Taubes, they see their life, part of their small job in life is to make sure nobody should ever be fooled by me. Mm-hmm. And then I have...
How does that feel, by the way?
It's weird. I mean, it's just weird.
Yeah.
And it's weird. I don't know if I said that. and then you have these people who, from their perspective, have been fooled by me and are, 100 pounds lighter, and their diabetes has gone away. And it's sort of, you've got all these, you've got companies that have started to treat diabetes based on my foolish thinking and are succeeding. And so I find these people compelling, but I guess the world is full of quacks who think that they have actually made people healthier, but didn't, because some people get healthier on their own. Mm-hmm. So it's a difficult try. I don't, just because I go to Brazil and I meet a few hundred people who have, maybe I killed few thousand people in Brazil who adopted low carb, high fat diets and just didn't go to the conference because they're dead. You just don't know.
You never know.
So you have to be this. In my talk, when I quote Richard Feynman, the physicist, saying the first principle is you must not fool yourself, and you're the easiest person to fool. You've always got to remember that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always just this high likelihood that somehow, just like gazillion people before you, you're fooling yourself.
Right. You never know anything for sure, I think. You mentioned a little bit about your early work in looking at physicists. And maybe can you give us, just for people listening who aren't so familiar with your path or your work, how did you get into, maybe even how you got into studying physics in the first place, and then to journalism and that?
Okay, so I was
a couple of books.
Yeah, I grew up reading science fiction books. So I wanted to be an astronaut. Everybody in the 60s, we wanted to be astronauts. Today, you want to be billionaires, but in the 60s, we wanted to be astronauts.
Okay.
So I figure if you want to be an astronaut, you study astronomy, and to study astronomy, you have to study physics. And I ended up getting a physics degree. I actually got a C- in quantum physics my junior year, and my advisor suggested that I find a different career path. But by that time, I had already enough credits to get a degree in physics. It was clear that I was not going to become a good physicist. So then I got a master's in engineering and decided, just because I wanted to stay in college, and then I had read all the President's Men about by Woodward and Bernstein about leading up to the impeachment of Richard Nixon, and I just, that was what I wanted to do in life. And so I applied to journalism school and I got accepted. And when I got out of journalism school, I wanted to become an investigative reporter, but turns out that since I hadn't worked on my high school newspaper, my college newspaper, my graduate school newspaper, I didn't really have great credentials, but I had this science background from Ivy League college, so I could get a job as a science writer. I could also stay in New York where my girlfriend lived.
Okay, which was, that's important too.
That's important. So I became a science writer. And a couple years into doing this, I realized that there's some bad science out there, and all you have to do is think critically and skeptically, and you could start asking questions, and it doesn't matter whether the guy who said something or wrote up a paper or a book has a PhD or 17 letters after their name. You're allowed to ask sort of critical, skeptical, like, something sounds like BS, it might be, whether it's science or not. And so I just did this. And then 1984, I had written a profile on this physicist that everybody knew was going to win the Nobel Prize, this Italian physicist named Carlo Rubbia, who taught at Harvard and worked at CERN, which is outside of Geneva, Switzerland. And I had done a profile for him for the magazine Discover, and Discover had an award where the Scientist of the Year, and Carlo had was Scientist of the Year, and he got a nice gold Rolex. And so he always felt indebted to me. And he came to Washington, and I think it was April 1984, the annual American Physical Society meeting, and he said he was on to the biggest breakthrough in 40 years in physics. Yeah. And it was the brand new, remarkable physics, and this would be even bigger than the stuff that won him the Nobel Prize. And all he had to do was turn on his accelerator and get a little more data, which they were going to do in September, and nail it down. And I asked if I could come live at the lab and write a book about it. It would allow me to write a book about a great scientific discovery without actually having to be as smart as the scientists who are making it. Because it's rare that people predict discoveries. So because of the gold Rolex, he was happy to let me come. And I got a book deal, and I moved to Geneva, and I got a room at the hostel on the laboratory. And today we would say I was embedded with the physicists.
Yeah.
And I was there for a couple months, and it was pretty clear after a couple months that there was something horribly wrong with his discovery. And the reason people don't predict discoveries is because if they don't have all the data, they haven't dotted every single I and crossed every single T, they don't know if they've made a discovery yet. So when somebody says all I have to do is get a little more data to nail it down, they don't know if they're right. They have no idea. They hope they're right. Everybody always hopes they're right, but they have no idea. So I ended up staying there for 10 months while they the researchers themselves slowly realized how they had screwed up and why they had screwed up. And I was dealing with the theorists at the laboratory, and there was another competitive experiment at the laboratory, and I was traveling around the world talking to other physicists, who it turned out this guy had screwed up numerous times in his past. In fact, the Nobel Prize-winning work was mostly wrong, but it had to be ultimately right, so it was still a safe prize to give. And people were happy to explain to me how he had screwed up in the past, and to talk about just, you know, I had sit down with Nobel laureates, and nothing made them happier than to explain how this guy was screwing up now and why they were better physicists. And so I got this really intensive education in how to think like some of the best scientists in the world. I wasn't clearly not as smart as they were, but there's a way of thinking about problems. One of them, Leon Lederman, who was ran the Fermi National Laboratory outside of Chicago and won the Nobel Prize for discovering the upsilon particle. But this is how physicists work. He actually discovered it twice. The first time he had made a mistake, and people called it the oops Leon. Like, even after he won the Nobel Prize, you were allowed to make fun of him for screwing up originally.
Wow.
Leon said he liked to walk around the laboratory at night and talk to the graduate students because they hadn't learned how to lie yet. And what I was doing living in Geneva was embedded with these. I wasn't just talking to the Nobel laureate, who was kind of a pathological liar. I was talking to everyone in the experiment. I was even, you know, I would go to dinner with the technicians. Yeah. I would go to dinner with the red physicists from the Redbrook Colleges in the Midlands of England who had built the equipment. They weren't allowed to do analysis. They had just built the equipment. They knew how the equipment could fool them. And then I would go to dinner and hang out with the young physicists who had come from Harvard to work with Carlo, who were like hotshots and just wanted to do analysis. And they had no idea how the equipment could fool them because they hadn't built it themselves. And I just, you realize doing this that, you know, when you're reading a paper or hearing a talk, you're getting the head of the project's spin on what they've done. And it's supposed to be the most negative spin. It's supposed to be, this is all the ways we could have screwed up. They could have screwed up this. We could have screwed up that. And we got to do more work. We hope. But it's invariably, unfortunately, spun to be more positive than it should be. So this kind of became, when I finished that book, it was called Nobel Dreams, I was just obsessed with this, how hard it is. And when the book came out, it's funny, there was an article in the New York Post about it, and I remember this, thinking my career was over. The headline in the New York Post was February 1987, was Egghead's Squabble Over Nobel Prize. And in this article, this Nobel laureate is calling me, I'm like 30 years old, calling me an asshole. And I think I'll never work again in the field.
Great first book, yeah.
And then as I'm doing interviews with scientists and we start talking about my book and Carla Rubbia, and they'll say, oh, if you think Carla is bad, you should write about so-and-so.
Wow, so you realize there's a lot to write about.
There's a lot to write about. So basically my career became doing these investigations on these scientists who just were more ambitious than they were good scientists. And I kept doing it. I moved into public health after my second book, when physicists said, well, if you're interested in bad science, you've got to write about public health. That stuff's terrible. And then by the late 1990s, I stumbled into the diet field.
Yeah, tell us about that. How did you end up in nutrition?
I was living in California, Venice Beach. I was a contributing correspondent for the journal Science, which means I'm a glorified freelancer. And I needed a paycheck to pay my rent. So I called up my editor and I said, hey, Tim, you know, I need a paycheck. Do you have a story I could turn over quickly? And the first DASH study had just come out. DASH stands for Dietary Approach to Stop Hypertension. Like the diet rankings from U.S. News and World Report consider DASH the first or second most healthiest diet around. They were publishing this paper in the New England Journal, and DASH lowered blood pressure as well as drugs did, and it didn't restrict salt, which was interesting. So I knew nothing about this. I hadn't written about the field. But the way you, when you get these, when you do these articles, the way it works is you, as a journalist. They send you the article. It hasn't been published yet. You call up the principal investigator and you interview them, and then you ask them for the names of a few people you could talk to who know mm-hmm. about the paper, even though it hasn't been published yet. Mm-hmm. And then you call them up and they comment. They say it's a great paper. This is why it's unique. And mm-hmm. it's sort of three interviews, a day's worth of work. You write it up. You get $1,000. You pay your rent.
And then the whole country is, this is the next best diet that
exactly.
we should all be following.
In this case, what I didn't know is the story had been, the paper had been leaked to Science.
Okay.
And the guy who leaked it provided a list of people to interview.
Mm-hmm.
So I call up the principal investigator. They, you know, tell me what the study is. Then I call up somebody from the list. And this is a former president of the American Heart Association.
Okay.
And she says she can't talk about the study or she'll lose her funding. And I say, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
This is not Lysenko era Soviet
yeah.
Union. The NIH doesn't pull your funding because you talk about a diet study in the New England Journal. And she goes, I can't do it. And I go, okay, let's do this. Let's just go off the record on background.
Yeah.
Because if you don't tell me what's wrong with this study, I'll never know. And then I'm just going to write it up and get my paycheck.
Yeah.
And 20 years from now, DASH is going to be the healthiest diet in America. And she refuses to talk to me.
Wow.
And then I call up one of these guys who the principal investigator told me to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, he starts yelling at me. He sounds exactly like Walter Matthau on the telephone. So it's really weird. It's like we're having Walter Matthau yell at you that there's no controversy over salt. There's absolutely none. There's no evidence that salt doesn't raise blood pressure. And I go, wait, professor. I'm not calling about salt.
Yeah.
Calling about the DASH diet study. And he goes, that's good because there's no controversy over salt and blood pressure. So I get off the phone. I call up my editor and I say, I had this American Heart Association woman refusing to talk to me because she'll lose her funding. And then I had this other Walter Matthau yelling at me that there's no controversy over salt and blood pressure when I wasn't calling about salt.
Yeah.
There must be some controversy over salt and blood pressure that I know nothing about. Yeah, I'm eating a low-salt diet
yeah.
like everyone else in America.
Right.
And so I'm going to turn this story over and get my paycheck and pay my rent, and then I'm going to launch into an invest. I'm going to just see whether there's something to the salt blood
mm-hmm.
pressure. So it turned out the key with DASH is it lowered blood pressure but didn't restrict salt.
Mm-hmm.
So that implied that salt wasn't that important.
People
and the guy who had leaked it, who since became a friend and ally, leaked it because he had been arguing that salt isn't the determining factor in raising our blood pressure. So that's, I spent 9 months on that story,
mm-hmm.
interviewed 85 people, read all the papers. This guy who had the Walter Matthau character, in the course of interviewing him again,
mm-hmm.
is clearly one of the worst scientists I'd ever interviewed. Remember, I'd spent like, since 1984.
Right.
I mean, just terrible scientist. And he took credit not just for getting Americans on the low-salt diet, but for getting us to eat the low-fat diet.
Mm.
So after he did that, I called up my editor and I said, look, when I'm done writing about salt, I'm going to write about fat. I have no idea what the story
yeah.
is.
There's
but
something there.
My experience is if a bad scientist is involved, he's not going to get the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of, if science is too hard, nature is too difficult to understand, the easy answers are all gotten 50, 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So that was it. I finished the salt story. It turned out that the evidence that salt causes hypertension is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a hypothesis, and people believed the hypothesis, and when the studies didn't agree with them, they found ways to reject the studies.
Mm-hmm.
And turned out the same for dietary fat. And once you realize that the evidence that dietary fat is, or saturated fat is causing disease, is shoddy at
mm-hmm.
best, it opens up a whole new world of ways to think about obesity. Because one of the things that happened is, until the 1960s, the belief was that carbohydrates were fattening.
Mm-hmm.
Bread, pasta, potatoes, sweets just made you fat. If you didn't want to be fat, you didn't eat them.
Mm-hmm.
And then we decided that dietary fat and saturated fat cause heart disease, and carbs became heart-healthy diet foods, and suddenly they were the foods we were supposed to eat. And then there were diets like Atkins, which just said, don't eat carbs. You could eat as much fat as you want.
Mm-hmm.
And those work tremendously for weight loss, but
mm-hmm.
people just assume they'd kill you because of the saturated fat.
Mm-hmm.
So now once I've spent the year of my life, interviewed I think 150 there were 155 researchers and administrators who had played some role in this dietary fat. So, I mean, I talked to everyone because I knew that if I talked to the graduate students, they might not lie to me.
Right.
You know, that
you
was
knew
kind
the
of
right
my
people.
Modus operandi.
Spent
so anyway,
that time in the labs.
Yeah, and then it just went from there, and then suddenly I become one of these people who's saying everything you think you know about nutrition is wrong.
Yeah.
Including like these just basic fundamental beliefs about fat accumulation, that it's like, oh, we eat too much, you know.
And so is this the time you when you wrote that initial New York Times article?
Yeah, this
about
is
fat.
So I did the science story on fat, which was called The Soft Science of Dietary Fat, and then I moved to New York, and this is how things work when you live in New York and you're a young, relatively young journalist. I had been introduced to an editor at the New York Times Magazine. It turned out we both liked to hang out in the same French cafe in the Village on Waverly Place. And so we would go and have lunch there like once a month and bat story ideas back and forth, and decided I would do this story eventually on what might have triggered the obesity epidemic, because you could localize it in time. And there are a few things that really changed when obesity rates started showing up. One was this institution of the idea we should all eat low-fat diets, which meant the carb is heart-healthy diet food. And then high-fructose corn syrup had been introduced, and it had replaced the sugar in Coca-Cola and Pepsi by 1984. And then total sugar consumption started going up from there, because we didn't recognize high-fructose corn syrup as sugar. So there were people like Michael Pollan and John Kritzer who were arguing that high-fructose corn syrup had triggered the obesity epidemic. I had this broader perspective that maybe it's all carbs, and then this awareness, which they didn't, that high-fructose corn syrup is just sugar in a different name. They're the same, you know, roughly half glucose, half fructose. So that led to the Times Magazine story and this kind of infamous maybe Atkins was right concept. And then I got a big book deal, which such stories will do. And then I spent 5 years of my life researching and writing Good Calories, Bad Calories.
And one of the most impressive things to me was how much went research goes into, you know, went into writing that book. And so you spent, can you tell us just a little bit about that, the time that you spent, the amount of research that you read and people you talked to in order
So what happens is, and I actually had lunch, about a year and a half in, I had lunch with my editor, because originally we had a two-year deadline for the book. And the idea was, you know, if I had taken the New York Times Magazine story and turned it into a book, sort of the Intelligent Man's Guide to Weight Loss, it's a massive bestseller, you know. And I actually sat down with my editor and I said, I know the book that will sell the best. And my my publisher was Knopf, which is, you know, the top two publishers in New York are Knopf and FSG. And my editor, I went with him because he had already at that point in time edited, I think, 8 Pulitzer Prize winning nonfiction books. I mean, just tremendous, amazing editor. And so we're having lunch and I say, you know, I know the book that will sell the best. It's this sort of Intelligent Man's Guide to Weight Loss. It's the Times Magazine story stretched out over 200 pages. I know the book my friends want me to write, which is that book. But as I've been digging into the research, and now the internet had come along, and suddenly you could find all the original papers. And when you found the original papers, you could then go through their references and find those papers, and you could go all the way back in time to the 19th century, and you could, you know, when people mentioned books, they used bookstores, now had their listings online, you could find the books and have them delivered for like $12 plus shipping. So I was collecting one of the biggest obesity, probably one of the 3 or 4 best private libraries on obesity. I was just, you know, any book pre-1990 I could buy for $7 and have somebody deliver it to me. And I it's the equivalent of talking to the graduate students is let's look at what the references actually say. So I said, as I start exploring this, I find that this idea that carbs are driving weight loss manifests itself in a whole host of different disciplines. And that it connects to heart disease and diabetes and heart, you know, cancer and Alzheimer's, and there's this whole revolution. So all these different fields, and it's like, it's imagine you hired me to, you know, excavate a gold mine that you thought went a quarter mile into a hillside, and I'm paid to do a quarter mile, but as we dig, we find that these veins go deep, and they have huge roots, and they go back miles and miles. And there's nobody's ever...
looked at this, yeah.
And I'm curious. I am inherently, I keep asking questions until there's no more answers that I haven't heard. Basically, when you start running out of questions to ask, it's time, like, you better start writing. And my editor said, look, we're Knopf. We're not in the business of making the most, publishing the book that makes the most money. We're in the business of publishing the best books. If you think this is a book you have to write, do it.
That's amazing.
So I just kept doing it. And then what happens eventually is you start running out of money. No matter how big the advances, you keep doing the research until you start running out of money. Then you decide you have to start writing because you need to get a paycheck when you turn in like half the manuscript.
Okay.
But now the pressure is so intense because you're running out of money.
Yeah.
That it's even harder to write. So there's this thing that no matter how big the advance, you always end up sort of in debt and nearly demented by the time you're done. But eventually it all came together and I'm kind of proud
of
it.
It's all worth it.
Yeah. And it was just, you know, the internet is what changed all this. So it's interesting. And I was thinking about this. In 1998, Malcolm Gladwell did a piece on, it's called The Pima Paradox for The New Yorker. And it was the first really magazine-length discussion of the obesity epidemic and obesity. And he said, you know, the conventional wisdom is we do this, and the diet book doctors say we do that. And considering how often the conventional wisdom is wrong in medicine, you should really, you know, always question it.
Right.
And then by the end of the book, he decides that, by the end of the article, he decides that conventional wisdom in this place was right. In part because Malcolm is lean and a runner. And when you're lean and a runner, you assume if everyone runs, they'll be lean too.
Right.
In part because he read some diet books that I didn't read that really sounded like quackery.
Okay.
Since then, I've read them, and it's like, oh, my God. That you know, sounds, these guys, it just sounds like they're snake oil salesmen. I mean, Atkins can sound like it's a snake oil salesman. But when you read, like, five of them, and they're all pushing different things, and they all, you know. And then I was just I was approaching it through the research itself. And by just 2 years later, 3 years later, there were already researchers who were taking Atkins seriously, because Malcolm got it right at the cusp of our awareness of the obesity epidemic. But now suddenly other researchers, people are having patients come in who try the Atkins diet and they get healthier and their lipids improve. And they go, Jesus, this is contrary to everything I believe. Maybe I should study it.
Right.
So just in the 3 years, I had this advantage of academic physicians who were saying, look, this diet just works and it makes people healthier. And that gave me a different perspective. And those 3 years are like all it takes. And then this, you know, kind of relentless curiosity.
And so
anxiety that you're wrong. What we talked about
earlier.
It's like if you're afraid you're wrong, you keep
asking
questions.
Stone.
To see like, okay, how did I screw up? Because, you know, most people like me are wrong.
And so this, and what year was the book published? It was
the 2000. Book was 2007.
Okay. So it's now been 10 years,
yeah,
over 15 years since you started this work. And it's very slow, but even I can tell over the last 8 years since I started medical school, there are changes happening in the conversations that are being had with patients. But what are the biggest changes? Maybe they seem small to you, but what are the biggest changes you've noticed in nutrition and kind of the conventional wisdom in medicine?
So when I started, the healthy diet was a low-fat, low-salt diet. That's how it was defined. And then maybe mostly plants, you know, just we knew that we should be eating a lot of
vegetables.
You know, our mothers always told us to eat vegetables. So nobody talked about the carb content of the diet, except the diet book doctors. Nobody even really talked about the sugar content. Sugar was just don't eat too much of it. You know, it's all calories, so just control your calories, watch your weight, and, you know, keep the fat down so you don't get heart disease. Today, I think almost universally, a healthy diet's defined first by its like low sugar, low refined. Don't eat sugar, don't eat refined grains. That's how we think of a healthy, you know, white bread. And the low fat thing's kind of gone away, and it's been replaced with this idea that you should restrict saturated fat. Animal fats replaced with vegetable oils. And the calorie thing, weirdly enough, is slowly going away. Like the CDC on its website used to say obesity is an energy balance disorder. Mm-hmm. And the last time I looked, I couldn't find that. Mm-hmm. Which I thought somebody at the CDC is thinking. Every once in a while, you notice, you know, changes that wouldn't have happened before this. So the New York Times, they have a column called Upshot, clinical investigators who analyze sort of the evidence base of, and they had a piece on orange juice being as bad as sodas. Okay. And it's like 20, like nobody would have ever done that 20 years ago. I tweeted about it. This is a sign of a paradigm shifting.
Yeah.
This just would not have happened 20 years ago. And partially, I mean, the world was going this way without me. I think I accelerated it a little. I got to sort of catch a wave that was beginning to build and help that wave break, and that wave is breaking. What hasn't changed yet, there's still resistance against. So actually, let me continue things that have changed. I think this idea that carbs are fattening is back.
Yeah.
You know, it's part of the conventional wisdom. If you talk to people about, you know, what are you doing to restrict, you know, get their weight under control, they'll say, well, I'm trying not to eat carbs. Difficult, but I'm trying not to do it. The idea that they should be eating a high-fat diet restricted in carbs. So keto is spreading. Keto's become a fad.
It's really... spreading.
Yeah, I like to joke that in Silicon Valley, everyone who isn't a vegan or microdosing with LSD is on a ketogenic diet. You know, who's under the age of 30.
One it's of like, those extremes, yeah.
Yeah. But it's spreading. I mean, so fast and so quickly that it makes me a little nervous.
Yeah.
Fasting, intermittent fasting is spreading. I know Jason Fung is here, and he really, you know, gets credit for pushing that. I mean, that has just... And I do it. I thought it was a fad, and I experimented with it beginning almost a year ago, exactly. And, you know, I lost weight. I didn't think I had to lose. I felt better. I have more energy. Now I'm an intermittent faster. I just say I don't eat breakfast.
Yeah.
But,
which is fascinating, because then, like you said, years ago, breakfast was the most important meal of the day, right?
Used to be breakfast. I mean, some people still say that.
Yeah.
I mean, what's weird is there are people pushing... time-restricted feeding.
Right.
It's just a book came out by a researcher at UC San Diego and a New York Times story. And unless I read the New York Times article wrong, they're arguing that breakfast is still the most important. You should just...
restrict your window.
Yeah,
and
it's sort of a wait, because I stopped eating breakfast and I got healthier, and that's an N of one, but I have to talk to those people. We're having an ongoing email exchange. So all those things have changed, and they're pretty cool. I mean, this general idea that it's not about calories, that obesity isn't an energy balance disorder, I see that changing. It's like there's bloggers who will say, well, nobody ever said that. You know, there's these phases of paradigm shifting where first they say that's ridiculous, and then they say, you know, we never said that anyway, and then they say, well, that's what we were saying all along.
Right.
And they've kind of moved to the we never said it was about calories only.
So we're getting there. We're getting there. It's interesting, though, too, how you said all these things like keto and the intermittent fasting, they are there in certain pockets in medicine, but they're coming in general from the general population. And, you know, patients are bringing it to their doctors and saying, I want to do this, or this is what I'm doing, and I'm getting healthier.
Well, and I think this is, you know, when I give myself credit in life, I think one of the things I did and Nina Teicholz did is we helped convince people that these diets won't kill you. So again, 20 years ago, the idea was, everybody should eat a low-fat diet. If you want to lose weight, you're low-fat, calorie-restricted. And if you do Atkins, it'll kill you. You're going to just drop dead.
Right.
I mean, any second.
So
saturated fat will clog the arteries, end of you. So we've gotten people past that. And the ADA, the American Diabetes Association, will say, look, these diets are acceptable for weight loss short-term, because we don't know the long-term. That's a major shift. And so now doctors can tell patients, and as we see, there are probably tens of thousands of doctors who are now prescribing it. And when your doctor tells you to do it, used to be your doctor talked you out of it. Like, but doc, I lost 60 pounds. You're killing yourself.
Right. Now, right, but you don't know what it's doing to your heart, you know.
Yeah, now it's the doctor's telling, you know, or the patient coming to the doctor. So you're seeing the disseminating through from the bottom up.
Yeah.
And one of the things I did in the course of this, I co-founded this Nutrition Science Initiative, thinking we had to change the science because it had to come from the top down. Mm-hmm. And I still think it has to come from top down also to change the medical organizations. But now, having failed with NUSI so far, maybe even done more harm than good, you see this bottom-up phenomenon. There was this interesting confluence a year ago where over 100 Canadian physicians write a letter to the Huffington Post saying that they eat low-carb, high-fat, ketogenic diets, and that's what they prescribe to their patients.
Yeah.
And their patients get healthier. Blood sugar comes down, is controlled, blood pressure comes down, weight comes down, diabetes is resolved, they get them off their medications, sometimes all of them. And this doesn't happen with the conventional therapy, and yet the Canadian Food Guide is still pushing low-fat foods and high-carb, and the U.S. News and World Report just 2 months later came out with their diet guides. And they rated 40 diets, and the low-carb, ketogenic, high-fat diets were like 35th through 40th of the 40 they rated. And so you've got this interesting phenomenon where the physicians are saying, look,
this is what's working.
This works. Yeah. I take people who have these intractable chronic disorders. Whether you think obesity is a disease or a disorder, it's intractable and chronic. People never get better. Type 2 diabetes is, you know, 1 in 11 Americans now, and I put them on these diets, and obesity reverses, and type 2 diabetes reverses, and hypertension goes away, and I don't care what you say. I want healthy patients. Nobody goes to med school to manage disease for a living. So I think there's definitely this revolution happening that, you know, we broke through the gatekeepers. So it used to be the American Medical Association said this is quackery. You go on these diets, you lose weight, and your doctor says you're killing yourself, or he sends you to your cardiologist who says you're killing yourself. It just, we got around that.
Yeah.
And now people go and they just see that they're healthier. Maybe they're going to die of heart attacks. You don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they put them on statins. You don't know either.
Right.
Well,
as far as we can tell, all the markers that we have
improve.
Are pointing in the right direction.
Yeah.
You
Except,
know?
Of course, LDL, which is
right.
God's joke.
Right. But you mentioned NUSI. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, about why you think it's so far failed, but what your, you know, why you formed it and what the intentions are and what you guys are working on there.
Yeah, so NUSI, the Nutrition Science Initiative, co-founded, I think, 2011, Dr. Peter Attia and myself. We had slightly different goals. My primary goal, I just wanted to see some studies funded that could test this energy balance idea, because I thought, you know, there had been so many misconceptions about how we think of obesity and the effect of macronutrients on hormones, on fat accumulation, and we spent a few months looking through every study that had ever been done, and they're all basically based on misconceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And when you begin a study with misconceptions, often they just assumed what was true that they should have been testing. So if you assume that obesity is caused by eating too much and you got to get people on calories, you got to restrict calories to lose weight, then you do the study with only 800 calories because you've already assumed that got fat to begin with by eating too much. And so we went through all of these. None of these studies actually properly tested the hypotheses. So I wanted to get these proper tests funded.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems with the field is there are like sort of physicians, researchers who buy into low-carb diets, and they do studies on them, and nobody reads their papers because they're seen as believers.
Right.
And so who cares what they write?
Right.
Who cares what they publish? This is a problem I have to talk to with Tom Seyfried, who's here talking about cancer. It's like you've got to get establishment people paying attention, and
People who are skeptical doing those same studies.
Our thinking was, in order to do that, let's find thoughtful people. And I'd interviewed virtually everyone in the field, so I had pretty strong opinions about who was thoughtful and who might be a good scientist if they hadn't been born under this wrong paradigm. Mm-hmm. And anyway, we funded four studies. One of them was a pilot study that just this sort of infamous study that ended up being led by this young researcher at NIH who had no clinical research experience. He was a modeler. You know, he does computer models.
Okay.
And we had all these thoughtful older researchers who were involved, but from our perspective, their job was to help him become a good scientist. Mm-hmm. And instead, we think, and I could be wrong, he would argue the opposite, but we think they allowed him to let them be bad scientists.
Yeah.
I mean, they weren't that great to begin with, because if I'm right, they were just, you know, they just kept generating papers that were sort of reconfirming an incorrect paradigm, and they weren't interpreting it. They weren't aware that there are other ways to interpret what they were doing. And mm-hmm. So anyway, this study got a lot of publicity. The researchers argued that it refuted this alternative hypothesis of obesity that I and others were pushing, that mm-hmm. this is a hormonal regulatory disorder and that insulin is driving the connection to diet.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, but I mean, look at the data. The data actually supports it. And they said, well, you're interpreting the data incorrectly. And we're saying they're interpreting the data through their bias. And it was just a mess. And you don't want to be in a position where you're saying that you spend $5 million of a philanthropist's money to get a bad piece of research published. That's bad publicity. But you also don't want to say it's better than it was. And, of course, they're saying that we are only saying it's bad because it didn't agree with what we believe. And we're saying, but it did agree with what we believe. You just buried that data.
Right.
And it goes back and forth. And this happens all the time in science. And ideally, the answer is do another study.
Mm-hmm.
Do it better.
Mm-hmm.
Fix the problems. So we did that. We had this other study we funded at Stanford University that always had limited interpretability. And it's funny, I found an email that I'd written in 2015 to my colleagues saying, when this study is published, it's going to be misinterpreted. And here's why it's going to be misinterpreted. We have to work to make sure that this misinterpretation doesn't happen. And we have to talk to the investigator about it. And then February 2018, it's published and it's misinterpreted. And, you know, some people got it right.
Right.
The New York Times, one of their reporters interpreted correctly. And then this other Upshot column misinterpreted it. Because they're just people. It's difficult. This whole thing is not. I was clearly naive when I started. We have two more studies that are in review at the moment. You know, I can't really talk about them.
Yeah.
They'll make Noosey less of a cock up. And then there are other studies that I'm trying to get funded. Noosey's kind of in suspended animation, and that we have medical research organization status, and we have some money left over that I'd like to spend on studies. But at the moment, the whole organization is, you know, it's me working for free as a hobby in Oakland, and then a science director in Philadelphia who gets, you know, paid weekly actually to function. And then we have a researcher and an accountant who get paid, you know, like on a freelance basis. So
more challenges than anticipated but a lot of that I think you talked about in your, or maybe at least referenced in your talk here about some of the challenges with doing this research today and with the way science is structured today. And I think you did a good job of contrasting, you know, even in the field of physics, how things are a little bit different, or how things were, you know, decades ago when people were really focused on studying one problem and dedicated to finding the answer to that.
Well, and this is the thing, and this is what we wish they would do in obesity.
Yeah.
So ideally, in an ideal world, the obesity community would say, yeah, we've got these epidemics, obesity's, you know, gone from 12% of the population in 1960 to almost 40% today, and diabetes went from, you know, 1% to 10% of the population, and we've completely failed to curb these epidemics. Actually, Tom Seyfried said something very similar about cancer.
Yeah.
Look, you've got cancer deaths per day have been going up year by year in the United States, and they're going up faster than the growth of the population, and that tells you your approach has failed and you don't really have to know anything else, although it's always a little more complicated. But in obesity and diabetes, it's not. I mean, if you just had to live through this period to know that the world looks different today than it is, and doctors' waiting rooms are different today than they were.
Yeah.
So the assumption is we understand the cause of the disease. And hey, we know what causes this. People eat too much, dude. It's like, and there's too much good tasting food available, and we don't exercise enough, and so we don't have to do anything more.
Mm-hmm.
And our argument has always been, look, when you've got an epidemic out of control and you completely and utterly fail to curb it. And actually, a year ago, the Director General of the World Health Organization gave her prediction for the likelihood that they would begin to curb this epidemic, not that they would reverse it, but that they would begin to curb it. And her prediction was 0% chance.
Wow.
So under those circumstances, a reasonable thing to ask would be maybe we don't understand the disease.
Right.
You know, if cigarette lung cancer cases were, or HIV cases had just continued to climb from the 1980s, you'd say to yourself, you know, we thought we understood the cause of AIDS. We were pretty sure it was the HIV virus, but it's now 40 years later and 40% of the population has AIDS. Maybe it's
problem.
Not HIV,
yeah.
And maybe it's not sexually transmitted, but clearly there's something we better be checking into because we failed. You know, if 50 years, in 1965, the Surgeon General puts out a report on you know, smoking and lung cancer, and we say, look, it's smoking causes lung cancer, and 50 years later, 40% of the population's dying from lung cancer, you would say, maybe it's not cigarettes, dude. Let's just look into it. I'm not saying it isn't, but
let's
there's some significant possibility we don't understand what's happening with disease. Let's figure it out. But what's happened in the U.S. with obesity and diabetes, our beliefs are so profound that obesity is just caused by taking in more calories than we expend. That's supposedly some law of nature, like it's the law of physics, and the laws of physics don't say anything about the cause of obesity. All they say is the laws of physics can't be broken, but they say nothing about the cause. But what we've done, beginning post-World War II in the U.S., the way research is funded, is you just give a lot of small grants to as many people as possible. So they're called R01 grants, $2.5 million over 5 years. It's $500,000 a year to do research and pay your lab technicians and, you know, give a overhead to universities. So all you could do is approach it with small problems. You got to do rodent research because nobody can afford human research. So you figure out what causes obesity in rats. And then you assume that that's true for humans. I mean, it's crazy. And so what you end up with is this system where people say, well, these are multifactorial complex problems. It's a little bit of this. It's a little bit of that. It's a little bit of everything that we've been giving money to. And nobody's saying, wait a minute. Let's take a step back. Let's go to examine our fundamental beliefs. Is this an energy balance disorder? Because here we have this guy arguing pretty compellingly that it's a hormonal disorder. You know, and like if you grew up with a sibling who was obese, or your mother had a hysterectomy and became obese, or your mother went through menopause, became obese, or you know you were the one who was obese, you're pretty damn clear there are hormones involved. In fact, if you went through high school and watched members of the opposite sex develop differently than you and accumulate fat or not accumulate fat differently than you, it's pretty clear that hormones are playing a role in fat accumulation. Maybe this is a hormonal thing, just like obese people used to claim. Maybe they do really get fat easier than lean people do. So let's examine that. And then you'd have some government committee say, look, here are these two competing hypotheses. We find this alternative hypothesis compelling enough that we have to test it and explore the possibility that this is a way to look at it. That's what you're trying to achieve. And hopefully they're all open-minded and they're smart scientists, maybe even pull scientists from other fields who don't come with these paradigms attached. And then you figure out how to do the experiments to do it right, and you have this kind of Manhattan Project approach to not building bombs, but figuring out what we don't know. You know, in the 1980s, when AIDS was new, we did a really good job mm-hmm. of approaching it without preconceptions mm-hmm. so we could identify what the cause was. Had we decided in 1980, you know, now if you were doing it, you've got all these people who are so programmed, it's HIV. I mean, it is HIV, mm-hmm. but assuming it wasn't, you'd have a real... So anyway, that's what I think you need to do. Yeah. The problem is we're still funding, you know, 10,000 researchers to publish 400 papers per week on obesity. It's like this huge noise-generating machine.
Right. You showed that graph in your talk of the number of papers yeah. on obesity, and it's just, it is. And there's no one can keep up with reading that, let alone draw any kind of conclusions from
yeah. Well, and the other problem is, so let's say one of the NUSI papers mm-hmm. really, one of our studies really comes up with very compelling evidence mm-hmm. that something we don't think is true is. Mm-hmm. So we've got 400 papers being published each week on the subject of obesity, according to, if you search PubMed with obesity as a term, I'd say there's 10 weeks of papers in print.
Wow.
That's 4,000 papers. So now, today, your study's published, gets in the New York Times tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It's big news. There's 4,000 papers coming down the pipeline that don't even know this finding exists.
Right.
It's like a tidal wave.
Oh, my gosh.
Or,
yeah.
you know, again, using the noise thing, it's right. like a rock concert worth of noise to drown out the sound of your soprano.
Right. We need to get back to quality over quantity.
Yeah. And then
Absolutely.
There's not just those 4,000 papers, there's probably another 10 weeks of papers that are being written up without any awareness
right.
that their thinking of obesity should change. There's another 2 years of experiments that are in the works. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, it's a tsunami of,
yeah.
and it's, you light this little match and it's supposed to light the darkness and it just, so on the other hand, the world is full of obese and diabetic people. Don't yeah. want to be obese and diabetic. And then their doctors are now going to say, why don't you try this diet? And if you commit to it, it'll make you healthy. And mm-hmm. people are finding out that it does. So I'm more optimistic today that the bottom-up approach is going to work and the top more pessimistic
right.
about top-down.
I think we're all seeing that. And the way yeah. the information is transferred now, and like you said, with the internet and with social media and people being able to share with their communities, their successes, I think is, that's how it's being spread. So.
And that's, yeah, and again, it's, the diabetes story is really interesting. What companies like Virta Health are doing in
yes.
San Francisco. So they go after type 2 diabetes, and the idea is to go after payers and providers mm-hmm. and employers to say, look, we can save you money.
Right.
Because we can take your type 2 diabetics and we can get them off their drugs. So mm-hmm. you pay us $2,000 a year instead of spending $8,000 a year on drugs.
Yep.
And you only have to do it if we succeed.
Yeah.
You've got nothing to lose.
Like a good deal.
Suddenly people see they can make money.
Right.
They can save money by making their patients or their employees healthy. Everybody gains except the sugar industry and
right.
the pharmaceutical industry.
Right.
But I think
it's happening.
We can
it
live
is
with
happening.
That. Yeah.
So through all of this research, how has your own diet changed over the years, and how do you eat now?
Okay, so I first did Atkins as an experiment. And so in the 90s, I'm living on this low-fat diet like
yep.
everyone else. And in fact, I'm living in Los Angeles, so it's probably a lower-fat diet.
Okay.
I might have been close to, I don't know, 20% fat. The only place I was getting fat in my diet might have been from these skinless chicken breasts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I ate a piece of red meat in the 90s. I'm gaining 2 pounds a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go from like 212, which was my boxing mm-hmm. weight, to 230. I'm working out an mm-hmm. hour a day. I seem to
Following
be in good
all
shape.
The advice, yep.
Yeah. And I think it's crucial to actually, it's funny, in this piece that Malcolm Gladwell wrote in the Pima Paradox, he talks about this phenomenon where diet book doctors always say they were getting fat and they couldn't stop it, and they went looking
yeah.
for a cure, and they found this thing to do, and then lo and behold, they magically lost weight, and they lost weight without even being hungry, and then they told their patients to do mm-hmm. and he said all the diet books have the same theme.
Sorry,
and they
yeah.
all do. And the reason they do is because if you're lean and healthy and you run marathons, you don't
look for it.
You don't look for any solution, and you think if everyone did what you did, but if you're not, if you're one of those of us who are just getting heavier,
mm-hmm.
you explore fad diets. That's what you do. And if you find one that works, it's like, Jesus, I did this. So I had actually an economist. I was working on this soft science piece for the journal Science, the dietary fad piece. And I was also writing a article for Discover magazine on the economics of the mathematics of the stock market. And I was interviewing this economist at MIT who ran the laboratory of financial engineering at MIT. And we started talking about the dietary fat science. And he said, oh, if you're doing a story on dietary fat, you have to try Atkins. He said his, so here it is, spreading from individual to individual. He said his colleague at Wharton, he co-authors papers with Professor Wharton, and Wharton guy has a father who lost 200 pounds on Atkins. So he went on it at MIT, and he's Asian American. He said, I basically gave up white rice. I lost 40 pounds. So I go back to California, and I try it, and I'm unmarried. I don't have kids. My mother has passed away, and my father won't care that much. If I give myself a heart attack, it's like, you know, these things happen. It's, so I experiment, and I'm eating eggs and bacon and sausage for breakfast and steaks for lunch and steaks for dinner and green salads, a lot of vegetables, because you end up telling, when you live in L.A. and you're a writer, you eat out every meal and you date waitresses. That's like the writer life. So you tell the waiter or the waitress, you know, hold the potatoes, give me a double order of broccoli, or give me a double order of salad. Breakfast is hold the toast, hold the potatoes, maybe give me some tomato slices.
And,
And I'm waiting for my heart to blow up. And while I'm waiting, I lose 25 pounds effortlessly. Like, it's like you walk down the street and the calories, the weight
just falls off.
So much so that I was working out an hour a day, and it was, you know, I'm running, I'm rollerblading from Venice up to Malibu and back. I'm doing these famous steps in Santa Monica Canyon. I couldn't lift weights because I bulk up so easily. And it's like, why bother doing all that now? I was doing it because I thought if I burned enough calories, I didn't have to starve myself. And now I'm losing weight effortlessly. I don't know why I do the running. I'm destroying my knees, which are now destroyed. I actually went back to doing resistance training because now I could lift weights and not blow up like a balloon. And it was a fascinating phenomenon. I mean, it's like, and I've said this to research, you have to understand this. You spend your whole life sort of cycling in and out of diets. I was a football player. I'm the kind of guy who gains weight easily. It's like, I know what it's like to have to lose weight and be hungry all the time and to eat small portions of food. And now I'm eating enormous portions and I'm losing weight. It's like, it's a different phenomena, trust me. And despite all of this, I, of course, fell off the diet and gained the weight back. I just started eating desserts after every meal, which might have been my body's way of trying to bring the carbs back. And there were some great desserts at the restaurants I went to in LA.
I don't doubt that.
Hal's on Abbot Kinney Boulevard made a bread pudding that I still, you know, will be my last meal if I don't have, you know, if I can think about it. Anyway, then I, about a year later after my article came out in the Times Magazine, I went back and, you know, it just worked. It's like, if I don't eat starches and sugars and grains, I can maintain a relative healthy weight and look good and feel good and eat pretty much food as I want. There's no sense of food restriction. So get back to the year ago, I said I started intermittent fasting, so I don't eat breakfast. And even that's interesting because I'm not hungry in the morning. So I mean, it's, again, it's, you know, it's almost 12:30 now. I haven't eaten since dinner last night. It wasn't a particularly large dinner, but I'm just not hungry. It's my body is perfectly happy to live off the fat I stored yesterday while I ate. When I do get around to eating, I tend to eat pretty much constantly from 1 o'clock to 7 o'clock. So I'm constantly eating salted roasted almonds or 100% chocolate or Kerrygold butter straight, or, and it doesn't seem, there's no sense of restriction. There's never any time when I'm hungry. There's never any time where I'm not eating large portions of food. It's an entirely different phenomenon. It's as though my body without carbs, and now with intermittent fasting works like my lean friends' bodies work all the time.
Yeah.
It just, you take away the carbs, mm-hmm. we're now kind of similar people. Mm-hmm. So it also fed my thinking that one of the, and it's something I'm going to say in my next book and hammer on, this idea that obesity is caused by consuming too many calories fundamentally is built on the assumption that lean people and we'll call them pre-obese people mm-hmm. are identical, except that the pre-obese people can't balance their intake with their expenditure. Mm. So they lack willpower, or they don't care, or right. they lack, you know. But other than that, they're identical. And one of the things I want to do is ask the researchers if this is how, like, let's say you have a lean person who's going to go on to be lean and a lean person who's going to go on to be obese. What mm-hmm. would you look for to predict which of the two is going to become obese? What's the difference between right. them? Because I think the only thing they could say is, well, clearly the one who's going to become obese is going to eat too much.
Yeah. So there's this, the insulin.
Yeah, there's this basic idea that it's just about the those about, of us who become fat yeah. are, we're like lean people, but we eat too much.
Right.
And so the idea then is, in order for us to be healthy, we should eat just like lean people, just less of it. Mm-hmm. So if they eat fruits and vegetables and pulses and beans mm-hmm. and vegetable oils, we should eat fruits and pulses and both. You know, if they eat a lot of whole grains, we should eat whole grains. Yeah. And the counter argument is, dude, we're not. Mm-hmm. You know, like my brother, who at his peak as an athlete, he was 6'5" and couldn't get above 195.
Wow.
And I had, like, you could see every vein in his body. He was a rower.
Okay.
And I was, like Freud said, anatomy is destiny. I was 6'2" and could get up to 240. I played
yeah.
football.
Yeah.
My brother was a good football player, but he couldn't get over 190. You know, he was a better football player than I was in high school, but mm-hmm. he couldn't get over 190. I could bulk up to 240 so I can play college ball. I was mm-hmm. shorter and chunkier our whole lives. I was always shorter and chunkier. I am not physiologically, we respond to food differently. Mm-hmm. My body wants to partition fuel differently. Mm-hmm. You know, our musculature isn't that different. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was weird. We tended to wear the same jacket mm-hmm. size, but my body stores fat and his body does not. Mm. And so foods that he can eat mm-hmm. are not foods that I can eat, because we have different hormonal responses. That's mm-hmm. the hypothesis. And, you know, it's a simple one. It says, like, I can't tolerate carbs. If I don't want to be fat, don't eat carbs. It's not that hard.
Right.
It's like this woman, Adele Height, who I've is quite clever. She's just not that difficult. It's like, just meat, green vegetables.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and it's like Greg Glassman's,
says, meat,
you know, meat, vegetables.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is it?
Some
meat,
fruit,
vegetables.
Little starch, and no sugar.
Yeah. And the only thing I would change, it would make the some fruit some berries.
I like that too.
Or
yeah.
some fruit,
no
some fruit
no bananas.
After your workout.
Yeah.
When it's being
yeah.
used just to, you know,
right.
restock glycogen. Right. And some of us, you know, if you're really predisposed. And some people are. Man, I have a friend now, when he was 18 years old, weighed 400 pounds.
Yeah.
I mean, he was different than I am. He's still different than I am. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be a much tougher battle for him his whole life. Mm-hmm. But he knows how to fight it, because it's not about starving right. himself.
And do you think those differences, are they genetic, environmental, epigenetic? How do we figure out which, is it just based on figuring out what works, or how do we figure out which people need to be more carb restricted? Just
you
knowing
know,
based
yeah.
on what
I
works.
Mean, it's like
yeah.
that's, and so on some level, ultimately, it comes down to self-experimentation.
Right.
Like when I started on Atkins, I was 230. I went down to 205. I'm 6'2". At 205, my wife said I looked emaciated. She didn't like. She thought I
too much.
I look emaciated. I'm 30 pounds heavier than anyone you know. And then I drifted slowly up to like 220 to 225, which, mm-hmm. you know, I'm now in my 50s. It's just like, that's kind of my, where my body settles yeah. with very few carbs. Add the intermittent fasting, I'm back down to 210. Mm-hmm. And I don't look emaciated. Mm-hmm. I can't explain it. But I would have been perfectly happy staying between 220 and 225. Mm-hmm. But I experimented.
Mm-hmm.
You
that's
know, if I'm...
A, yeah.
I had a patient. I'm a journalist. I can't have patients. But if I know someone who's 300 pounds and they give up carbs and they get to 200, but they're a woman, they would prefer to be 150. Now, maybe they'll never get to 150. Maybe 200 is the best they can do. Mm-hmm. Had they never eaten carbs in their life, they may never have gotten heavier than 150 to begin with. Mm-hmm. You know, these are questions you can't answer. Like, if their mothers had not done what their mothers did, because there are epigenetic effects. Right. So these are effects, I think of them as intrauterine effects. While the baby's in the womb, if the mother's obese or diabetic or pre-diabetic or gestationally diabetic, that baby's going to see a high blood sugar environment, and it's going to respond by developing more insulin-secreting cells, and it's likely to then, you know, and these studies were done in the Native American tribe, and it's very clear those kids are at increased risk of obesity and diabetes. It's easier for them. So if your parents are, your mother particularly, is obese or diabetic, I mean,
you have a lot more to work against,
Yeah, and if she just gained a lot of weight in pregnancy, you know, my generation, a lot of the women, there was this, I don't know what happened. Well, I do know on some level they were living on, like, high carb, high sugar foods because the doctors thought it was good for them, and they gained like 40, 50 pounds during pregnancy.
Yeah.
Whereas my mother probably gained 18 or something. Mm-hmm. That was the advice back then. So, you know, there's a lot of fixing that has to be done, all sort of up and down the, you know, from pregnancy onward.
Right.
But clearly some people are, they're genetically predisposed, they're biologically, whether it's, you know, and then they're programmed in the womb by the mother's blood sugar insulin environment to be predisposed, and they're going to have a much harder time. And when they have kids, their kids are going to be fatter and more diabetic still, unless we approach this problem in pregnancy.
Right. On that note, when you mentioned fruit after workouts, how do you, I'm assuming your diet is ketogenic based on what you're telling me, or do you, is that something that you measure or that you are, have any awareness of?
I do not measure it. I never measured ketones.
Okay.
my wife has a very sensitive sense of smell, so she'll also often tell me I'm in ketosis and just like go eat something or have a piece of fruit or something and get out of it. That's her thinking. I don't know actually how much of a role ketones play. So one of the things I did last fall is I interviewed 100 plus physicians and dietitians who prescribe these diets. And almost very few of them said they really care if their patients are in ketosis, and they don't aim for ketosis. They just say, get rid of these carbs, eat this as much as you want. And then if they find that they're not losing weight or they're plateauing with a lot of fat, then they'll use, you know, ketone measurements as a way to assess whether or not the patient is complying with the diet. Are they really following it? Because if they're in ketosis and not losing weight, that's a different issue than if they're not in ketosis and not losing weight, then we could see what happens if we clean up their diet and get them into ketosis.
Right.
Ketosis is a sign that you're mobilizing fat and oxidizing it. Also that you have a lot of fat in your diet. So my thinking on that is pretty simplistic and just, you know, these carbs are fattening, don't eat them. Not green leafy vegetables, but starches, grains, sugars.
And then what about for athletes? Or like we're talking about here in people who are doing CrossFit, who are doing a variety of endurance and power types of exercise, do you think that there's a role for more carbohydrates there in relation to exercise?
And I suspect there is. This is not my area of expertise, but you could think of it as certainly like sugar. It's a kind of performance-enhancing drug.
Sure.
You know, when my kids go to college, I'm not going to deter them from having a Coca-Cola before an exam, because if they can sit still, I'm pretty confident that it will enhance their performance. Better than Ritalin, which all their friends will be doing, which is already enhancing their performance. you know, it's quite possible. And again, I think self-experimentation is necessary. There are a lot of people arguing that, you know, once you're in ketosis and you're burning ketones and you've got this free sort of very flexible fuel supply, that enhances some athletic performance. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm certainly stronger than I used to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's weird. I'm 62. I'm stronger than I was. I could do more pull-ups than I could when I was playing football and working out 2 hours a day.
Crazy.
Although I'm also 30 pounds lighter.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I don't buy that it impacts, even if it impacts muscle mass, I don't buy that it impacts strength, because I can see that I just personally got stronger, mm-hmm. the fewer carbs I consume. But I'm not doing these other exercises. Mm-hmm. So, and they're all, I imagine, all have particular stresses and challenges, mm-hmm. and some people will find that they do better with carbs or even with sugar, and some mm-hmm. people won't, and then it's a trade-off. Mm-hmm. I don't think the goal in life should just be to live as long as humanly possible. Right. You know, we're trading off.
Enjoy our time while we're here, too.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's true. One thing. I do think that many people who are obese and diabetic would be happier if they weren't.
Right.
Even if they have to go through a period, like when I'm happier not smoking cigarettes than I was smoking them, even mm-hmm. though getting
process.
To be a non-smoker was a pretty miserable experience and took me years.
Right.
And, I mean, you know, so I think these are some of the issues we confront. Mm-hmm. I recently, so Christopher Gardner did this study that Nusi funded at Stanford, where he compared people on what he called a healthy low-carb diet, mm-hmm. which is no sugars and refined grains and vegetable oils, and then low carb, higher fat, to a healthy low fat diet, which is no sugars, no refined grains, no vegetable oils, and lower fat.
Okay.
So it was a flawed study to begin with, because both trials, you're removing sugar and refined grains,
right.
which are what we're arguing is the cause, the fundamental cause of the excess weight. So I met this woman who, a professional woman, Stanford graduate, who was she was telling me she was a subject in the trial, mm-hmm. and she's obese, so she's 240 pounds, maybe 5'7", and she showed me her weight loss, and she was in the low-carb arm, so mm-hmm. for 3 months, she lost 30 pounds in the first 3 months
wow.
on a low-carb diet, which is pretty spectacular,
a lot,
10
yeah.
pounds a month, 2.5 pounds a week.
Yeah.
And then they said, look, if you really miss any carbs, we urge you to add them back, because we don't want you to fall off the diet. So not a lot, but a little.
Some.
So, you know, you stay in the study. So she added 3 months, she added berries back.
Okay.
And she lost 5 pounds in the next 3 months.
Wow.
And then she added fruit back and never lost another pound.
Interesting.
So the investigator's idea was, we don't want people to drop out of the study. Mm-hmm. So if they're really missing carbs, they're going to drop out. Nobody could sustain a ketogenic diet. That's mm-hmm. too difficult. So let's let them eat. As soon as she added the berries back, her weight loss effectively stopped.
Interesting.
And I've read this in the literature, and,
yeah.
and you know, and I mentioned in Good Calories, Bad Calories, this clinician at DuPont in Delaware in the 50s saying he had one executive who lost 50 pounds effortlessly on a low-carb diet, and if he added a single apple a day, would stop his weight loss.
Huh.
So with this woman, she missed her berries.
Mm-hmm.
But I said to her, is it difficult conversation to have. Let's imagine you never added the berries back, and instead of plateauing at 205, you plateaued at 140.
Mm-hmm.
She hadn't been 140 since she was like 12.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you wouldn't miss the berries. And maybe your body changes its physiological state. The berries could be part of a sort of insulin-related carb craving, and when you're living on fat and you're freely burning your own fat,
yeah.
maybe you won't even crave the berries. When I was eating a low-fat diet, my luxury in life as a struggling journalist was fresh orange juice,
mm-hmm.
Fresh squeezed. You
sure.
had to pay like twice as much, and it only lasted a couple days. And
right.
I thought orange juice was God's way of getting the taste of the night out of your mouth. And then when I tried Atkins as an experiment, the orange juice was the hardest thing to give up.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just craving this
mm-hmm.
orange juice, and
just
I realized that
morning.
It's all about the sugar. Today, I couldn't imagine having a glass of orange juice any more than I could imagine smoking a cigarette. I mean, it's like, why would I
do that? Yeah.
So my body has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And my fuel supply has changed. I now live on, I burn fat and ketones,
mm-hmm.
some ketones,
mm-hmm.
man, you know, for fuel.
Yeah.
I don't need that carbs, and my liver doesn't particularly want to deal with the fructose. So this could happen to her too, but if you decide that you miss the berries, You never get the chance to see what's possible and then to make an informed decision about what the risks, what you really, how you want to live.
Right.
So one of the ideas that these doctors told me and that I want to communicate in my book is sort of how, if you commit and you really, then you get to find out what's possible. Mm-hmm. Like, what can your body be? How can you feel? And then you can decide, look, okay, I'm 100 pounds lighter, but I just
life
without.
I really miss berries, yeah.
I mean, I gave up coffee for a year, a couple of years ago. And at the end of a year, I mean, I didn't have all caffeine, no tea, no decaf, At the end of a year, I said, this isn't worth it.
Yeah.
You know, it just isn't life. There's no reason to get out of bed without a cup of coffee.
I did the same thing. I've only done it for a few months, but I felt better. I felt like I didn't feel as, my energy was more even throughout the day, all those things, all these benefits, but I love that cup of coffee in the morning.
You know what's funny is when I did it when I was younger, I felt better. In fact, I loved the feeling of waking up refreshed and awake and not sort of dragging yourself to the kitchen and pushing the button and staring at the machine until you could get your drug. But when I was older and did it, I never got to that point. And I expected to, and I didn't think it would end, but I said, I'm going to do it for a year. And like on day 366,
you were ready with
that cup of coffee was the best cup of coffee I ever had in my life.
I bet it was.
So I get it. Yeah. I understand. And I'm probably healthier without the coffee. I don't know.
Yeah.
I understand, but I got to make that decision.
And again, it's that personal experimentation and how all of us are a little bit different and we have to go down, you have to put that investment to figure out for yourself.
Yeah.
But I know we need to wrap up. So I have a couple of quick questions that I ask everyone on the podcast. At the end, the first one is three things that you do on a regular basis that have the biggest positive impact on your health.
Okay, I don't eat sweets.
Yep.
It's funny. I have mixed feelings about exercise. I mean, I love it and I do it, but I'm also getting my knee replaced in a month. Oh. I have back issues, so I can't. I look good.
History of football and it's true. It's what's the most healthy form of exercise over the course of your life.
Yeah, so it's sort of, I'd probably be better off if I was, when I did do it, I took a little easier. So I'm going to say, that basically not eating sweets and probably not eating grains and starches and then even now the intermittent fasting. Mm-hmm. Although I could add, having a wonderful family and,
That's important too.
Those things, I'm sure. And we just got a dog. And if the dog would stop, would get, actually be as house trained as we thought he was. Sure, that would improve my health as
definitely,
well.
Definitely. Definitely. So. What type of dog did you get?
A rescue from Korea.
Oh, wow. That's very cool. That's our next thing. We keep talking about it, but
just don't fool yourself like we did into thinking that they're house trained when they're not. There was a room that we didn't go into all that much, but apparently he did. That was my
nice surprise.
Life experience the other day. Yeah.
Nice surprise. All right. Okay. Next question is, what is one thing that you're working on or that you think would have a big impact on your health, but you have a hard time implementing it?
That I'm working on.
Or an experiment you're trying.
Again, I'm having my knee replaced next month. So my right leg hasn't had cartilage since 1974.
Ooh.
So it is, bone on bone, and that means, and I'm a big guy, so I haven't been able to run really for 10 years. I have back issues, which are probably because I can't straighten this leg, so I walk. So it could be that, knock on wood.
Hopefully we'll see you running and doing.
Because other than that, I live a pretty healthy lifestyle, so it's sort of,
Yeah. Okay, well, good.
Maybe I could spend more time with my kids.
Sure.
Having mentioned the family.
Yeah.
Probably be healthy for all of us.
Yeah, we can all spend more time with our families, I think. Last question is, what does a healthy life look like to you?
What does a healthy life look like? I mean, again, it's you're lean and healthy, which means if you have to do that by restricting carbs and eating fat, then that's what it is. It's certainly minus processed foods and sweets and other, addictive substances within reason.
I love it.
That's a tough question. Because that's not nearly as simple as one would think.
People take it in a lot of different directions, so it's interesting to hear where it goes.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for sitting down with me. This has been really great.
Well, thank you.
I appreciate it.
It's been fun.
Hey there. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode. I loved hearing Gary talk, especially about his own personal nutrition journey in this episode. I think there's nothing more powerful than self-experimentation in your own N-of-1 experimental process. Now we want to know, what types of diets have you personally experimented with? Which way of eating allows you to feel at your best? Let us know on social media using hashtag Pursuing Health. To make sure you never miss an episode and to receive exclusive content from me, head to my website, juliefouché.com, and subscribe to my email list. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe and consider giving the podcast a 5-star rating on iTunes. Also, don't forget to share your stories. If you or someone you know has used lifestyle to overcome a serious health challenge, please send me an email at info@juliefouché.com. I'll choose some of these inspiring stories to share here on future episodes. Don't forget you can train with me through Beyond the Whiteboard by visiting trainwithjuliefouché.com. Thank you again so much for listening, and I'll catch you next time on Pursuing Health. This episode is brought to you by a company that's made my life significantly easier, and that's Thrive Market. Thrive Market is an online marketplace, and they're on a mission to make healthy living easy and affordable for everyone. It allows you to shop for thousands of the best-selling non-GMO foods and natural products, always at 25 to 50% below retail prices. But as a Pursuing Health listener, you'll receive an additional 25% off your first purchase, plus a free 30-day trial if you visit www.thrivemarket.com/ph. My husband Danny and I have been ordering from Thrive Market for years, and it's helped us to maximize our efficiency with grocery shopping and meal prep in the midst of our busy schedules through medical training. Using Thrive Market, we can shop for all of our staple grocery items, things like nut butters, cooking oils, snacks, dressings, coffee and tea, even personal care products, eco-friendly cleaning supplies, and non-toxic beauty products. We know that they're coming from a curated list of products we can trust. Whether you're looking for paleo, vegan, ketogenic, gluten-free, non-GMO, sustainably farmed, fair trade certified, or any of 80 plus other types of products, you can easily find them by filtering on Thrive Market's platform. And they're all at prices 25 to 50% below retail. Even better, these items are shipped straight to your doorstep, so you never have to worry about the time or hassle of grocery shopping. Here's a few other reasons to love Thrive Market. First, they're the very first company in the country to go 100% zero waste. All of their packaging, boxes, and inserts are made from recycled paper and are recyclable themselves. They're the largest retailer in the country that sells exclusively non-GMO groceries, and more than 70% of the Thrive Market catalog cannot be found on Amazon. It provides greater access to high-quality products at prices comparable to conventional products in supermarkets. This helps to decrease the barriers to healthy living for everyone. We also have the opportunity to vote with our forks every single day to change our food environment in this country, and Thrive Market can help us do so by supporting companies that are also working towards this mission and producing high-quality, healthy, and sustainable foods. So that's why I love Thrive. Thrive's mission again is to make healthy living easy and approachable to everyone, and this aligns perfectly with my own personal mission and that of Pursuing Health. Because it's been such a lifesaver for me, I wanted to share the benefits of Thrive Market with all of you, and they've responded with an amazing offer. So once again, head to thrivemarket.com/ph to receive 25% off your first purchase plus a free 30-day trial. Again, this is on top of their already 25 to 50% below retail prices. Why not try it out and do your grocery shopping from home this week? I hope you can take advantage of this offer and enjoy their service as much as I have. Once again, head to thrivemarket.com/ph to learn more. No discount code necessary. Just shop around and the discount will be applied at checkout. This episode is brought to you by ButcherBox. ButcherBox delivers 100% grass-fed and finished beef, free-range organic chicken, and heritage breed pork directly to your doorstep. Now, I think meat can have a place in a well-rounded diet, but there is a huge, huge difference when it comes to animals raised in feedlots that are fed primarily corn and soy and routinely given growth hormones and antibiotics, and those that are responsibly raised, fed their natural diet, and never given growth hormones or antibiotics. ButcherBox gives me some peace of mind, knowing that I can trust my meat is the highest quality out there and that it will taste amazing. They allow you to order curated or custom boxes of meat, and they always come with recipe ideas for you to explore. My husband Danny and I are super excited about firing up our backyard grill this summer to enjoy our ButcherBox selections with tons of vegetables from our local CSA. And you can join us. ButcherBox is extending an awesome offer to you for listening to Pursuing Health. Just head to butcherbox.com/Julie for $20 off your order, plus a free order of their delicious bacon. Again, that's butcherbox.com/Julie. Hope you can check it out and that it makes your life a little bit easier, just as it has done for us.